time and a half does not level the playing field. And that's the minimum that they're allowed to approve now. And that's just like, it's laughable. I mean, it's just absurd that somebody should have that much more time.
Hello and welcome to episode 446 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson, and with me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Be LSAT famous, share news, and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. This is going to air on Monday, March 18th, and in just a few hours, you can join Chris, one of our great reading comp passage teachers. He's going to teach a class called The Final Passage that will be at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can sign up for that at lsatdemon.com/free. If you miss that class, you can also watch the recording by going to lsatdemon.com/classes. Anything you want to add to that?
It's a high level class. It's like a advanced level RC class. Mm. And Chris is one of our very best teachers. So you want to see the best of what the Demon has to offer, you should definitely check out that class.
Great. Yeah, we have an email here from Manan. The subject is 175 target score.
Hello. Some days back, I subscribed to the Demon and have already started seeing progress. My diagnostic score was a 152, and my target score range is between 173 and 175. Very specific goal there, huh, Ben?
Yeah.
Currently, I'm getting 7 questions wrong in logical reasoning in each section. I've noticed a pattern where I tend to get questions wrong in the last part of the section. I study at least 2 hours a day, and my current streak is 15 days. That's awesome. Ben, the Demon keeps track of students' streaks. And what do you have to do, Ben, to maintain your streak in the Demon?
You just have to answer one question a day. Obviously, this student is doing a lot more than that, but that's all you have to do.
Cool. I have seen comments like on our LSAT Demon Discord community that we have for our students, including our free students. You can go to lsat.link/discord if you want to check that out. But I've seen students posting about how like their Demon streak is like precious to them, and that they're like, I can't lose. Like, it stresses me out so much if I might lose my Demon streak. And so, maybe people, that's great. It seems like it's motivating, which of course is the only point of having a streak leaderboard.
Sure. Yeah. I don't want people getting stressed out about though.
Yeah. You know, well, I mean, I don't know. It seems like they're stressed.
Mild stress.
In a good way, right? It's like, yeah. Okay, I want to, yeah. I have this discomfort because I know that I haven't done anything to move me toward my LSAT goals today. And all I have to do is log on and answer one question. Do you have to get the question right?
No.
Okay. Just have to log on and do a question.
Yep.
Interesting. Manan continues. I became a subscriber 20 days ago. Is it realistic to achieve this score of 173 or 175 for me? I understand that first I have to consistently score above 165. And then move forward. Necessary assumption and parallel reasoning seem to be my weakest points. My final question is, as a non-native speaker, how do I get into the rhythm of reading and understanding these complex reasoning questions within 2 minutes? Ooh. Because this seems to be one of the major factors. Thank you.
Yeah. So your problem isn't time. It isn't trying to get these questions within 2 minutes. Your problem is understanding, and that's going to actually require you to slow down and get better at reading. And that's not unique to non-native speakers. That's everyone. Everyone is trying to go too fast at the beginning, and they just need to let go and focus on comprehension.
Remember, they said, I'm getting 7 questions wrong in LR in each section. I tend to get questions wrong in the last part of the section. I mean, two things. One, that's where the hard questions are. You know, you better make sure that you're getting all the earlier ones right, because those are the easier ones. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to the end of the section, those are the harder ones. Two, if you think you're going to do those harder ones in 2 minutes, you're wrong. Those harder ones are going to take even me or Ben sometimes a lot longer than 2 minutes. So if you're looking at each question and trying to keep it within 2 minutes and patting yourself on the back when you do it right, when you get it within 2 minutes, and like being mad at yourself when you don't get it within 2 minutes, I think you've got two problems there. One, you're probably doing the easy ones maybe too slowly, because 2 minutes on some of the easiest questions isn't enough, which means you're probably not predicting answers. You're spending way too much time in the wrong answer choices. You're comparing answer choices to each other instead of predicting the answer and just easily dismissing wrong answers. So you're not doing those ones fast enough or confidently enough, I should say. And then you're trying to rush through the hardest questions, which many of them can't even be answered in 2 minutes. Shit, Ben, you and I, we did a joint class yesterday, right? And we muddied up, or especially I muddied up, one of those questions. We're like talking about the same question for 20 minutes until it finally clicks.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this student is really misguided by trying to time individual questions. That's causing lots of problems here. And you just need to, you need to give up on the idea that you're ever going to finish the section. You know, you don't ever need to finish the sections in order to score 173 to 175. That's your goal. Well, you don't need to do all the questions to score 173 or 175. In fact, it's going to be much easier for you to reach 173 or 175 if you stop trying to finish all the questions. I like what they said about, I understand that I have to consistently score above 165 first.
Mm-hmm.
But there are lots of intermediate goals before you even get there. I mean, you started at 152. The easiest way to get to 155 is to do like half the questions in the section and just make sure you get them all right. To get 160, you need to do like 2/3 of the questions maybe and get them all right. To get to 165, you need to do no more than 75% of the questions, I would think, and get them all right. I'm just roughly estimating here, but you've got to slow way down and start dominating each question individually. Then eventually the speed will build naturally, but not if you try for speed.
Yeah, I mean, and I think your point about the scores is exactly right, but I would just go a step further and say, don't even worry about the LSAT scores. Just shift your focus entirely to the accuracy score that you get at the end of each section. Just, okay, what was my accuracy? Was it 95 to 100%? Anything less than that, you're going too fast.
Yeah. I'm getting 7 questions wrong in LR in each section. I don't care about that. And I really don't care. Like, if you don't do the last 10 and you miss all of those, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
How'd you do on those first 15 that you did attempt? Because if you got all 15 of those right, then you're on the right track. That's progress. Because eventually you'll be able to effortlessly start getting to 16 questions and getting all of those right. And then effortlessly 17 questions and getting all of those right. And it's just not too far until you're getting 18 or 19 in a row at the beginning of the section. And now you're already outscoring where you're currently scoring, but you're doing a lot less work to get there. So I like that, Ben. Focus on the accuracy score. Whenever I work with students, it's like, show me a question that you missed. Let's talk about a single question that you missed. I don't want to hear about, I have a problem with necessary assumption or I have a problem with parallel reasoning. Show me one question that you missed. And if it's one of those, and if there's some, you know, tactical thing that you're not doing right about that question type or something, then yeah, we can dig into that. But it always just needs to be within this context of, I expect to get all of the questions that I attempt right. Here's one that I attempted and I missed it. What can we do about that? Thanks for writing in, though. That's an excellent question.
You know, as you were talking, I was just thinking about like the car crash analogy. I don't know if this is a good one or not, but I do feel like getting a question wrong is kind of like a car accident where the driver gets out and says, wow, I wouldn't have had this accident if this tree wasn't right here. It's like, no, the problem isn't the tree. The problem isn't the thing that happened right at the end. The problem is the things that led up to it, right? You were going too fast. You weren't paying attention. You were on your phone, whatever it is. And it happened even yesterday in our joint class, right? Someone was like, oh, well, I was between B and C, and this is why I don't understand B. And it's like, when we walk back through the issue, it's because they don't understand the argument.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. It's like the problem might not even have been when you went off the road.
Yeah.
Or the problem might not even have been that you were speeding. The problem might have been the 7 beers that you had at the bar before you got in the car. Or the problem might have been that you were late to go pick your kid up from school. Yeah. And that's why we can let go of the car crash analogy. But no, the problem is always earlier. And it actually goes back to what we were just telling Manon. Your problem, like, you think your problem is the end of the section.
Yeah.
But your actual problem is that you're not dominant enough in the beginning of the section.
Yeah.
That's why, like, and I guarantee you're also missing some of those questions.
And so it doesn't mean to go fast. Dominant doesn't mean, oh, I'm going to crush it through the beginning of this. No. It means you're going to do very well on the questions you attempt.
Yeah.
Slowly.
I mean, I think it does mean that you're going to go quickly through the answer choices, though, right? On a first
three, and eventually you'll get fast on those
and
questions,
and eventually
too.
You'll get fast on everything. But you got to attack that argument well enough to understand what's the evidence, what's the conclusion, why is that bullshit, or what's the evidence, can this evidence be used to prove anything else? Just make sure you really understand what's there. Then you've got to really understand the question that they're asking you, because you definitely can't answer the question if you don't know the question that's being asked. Then you've got to have some idea what you're looking for before you wade into the swamp of the wrong answer choices. Those wrong answer choices are tough, and they're going to be time consuming if you don't know what you're looking for. You've got to be able to quickly dismiss wrong answers and know that answers are wrong before you even finish reading the answer a lot of the time. That's how you develop that effortless speed that actually leads to people, you know, finishing the section. And people can and do score perfectly on logical reasoning sometimes. But the way that happens is by dominating the argument, not by like trying to rush through it and spending a whole hell of a lot of time on answer choices.
Yeah, totally. So let's talk about accommodations. Before we get into the data that we have here, I want to give a little bit of a background. We've talked about accommodations on the show a lot, but for context, it's 2024. And 10 years ago, in 2014, LSAC, the makers of the test, were sued by some department of housing or something. I'm not exactly sure why they were suing, but they sued LSAC, and the consent decree that came out of that lawsuit required LSAC to change their accommodations policies, which had two big effects. One, they loosened those policies, so it made it a lot easier for people to get accommodations.
Yep.
And two, the number of people who applied for accommodations went up dramatically, maybe because they figured out it was easier to get them. But we have data from LSAC from 2014 to 2017, and they noted that a lot of accommodated test takers went up. And we don't have any data since 2017, but since that time, we've had COVID. The test has been restructured, and the number of scorers in the top scores, 170 plus, 165 plus, has almost doubled, or has it more than doubled? Either way, it's gone up a lot for the high scores, right? And the question, of course, is why? Are people just getting better at the test? Is it because the test has now changed from a 4-section test to a 3-section test? Is it because the test is now taken at home? Is it because more people are getting accommodations? So we've always speculated about these reasons, and it's possible that all of them are contributing to these higher test scores.
Yep. So the LSAC report is entitled Accommodated Test Taker Trends and Performance for the June 2012 through February 2017 LSAT Administrations. And it has a bulleted summary at the top with a bunch of trends. So here's what the trend was at the time. The number of requests for accommodations greatly increased across the five testing years, starting at 1,581 in 2012-2013, to more than doubling to 3,789 in 2016 to 2017. And now we're in the what they would call 2023-2024 cycle. The number of approved accommodation requests increased across the five testing years from 729 to 3,000. So they went from approving half of their accommodations requests to approving 80% of their accommodations requests.
Yeah.
In the first two study years, the learning disorder category comprised the largest number of test takers. The attention deficit / hyperactivity disorder, ADD, ADHD, category overwhelmingly comprised the largest number of test takers in the last 3 years of the study. So it was actually people, so the mix of people requesting accommodations after the consent decree changed from people looking for learning disorder categories. Now it says overwhelmingly ADD, ADHD overwhelmingly comprised the largest number of test takers in the last 3 years of the study. This is back in 2017, so we don't know what the current issue is.
We don't, but I wonder if the consent decree, well, by making the policies looser and easier to get accommodations, that's before ADHD was just not accommodated.
Well, how easy are they to get now, Ben?
We haven't heard one person write in to tell us they were denied.
We've been doing this podcast for coming up on 10 years, I think.
Yeah.
And we've said since the beginning, pretty much, like, no, if you have a doctor write you a note, you will get accommodations. And you can find, please tell us, because we want to know. We genuinely want to learn about this issue. But we're at LSAT Demon everywhere. And you can visit our website, thinkinglsat.com. to give us your story. But if, like, we just haven't heard of people getting denied accommodations since we've been asking people to tell us that they got denied for accommodations. So it seems like what happened was, after this consent decree, I mean, they lost a lawsuit and they had to agree basically to just loosen up the standards. And so it has become now where it looks like anybody with access to healthcare gets accommodations, because all you have to do is have a doctor write you a note.
Yep.
That's problematic, isn't it, Ben?
That is problematic.
We have unequal access to healthcare in this country. And it's, I don't think it's their fault. I don't think it's LSAC's fault. It's this lawsuit seems like it was, I don't know, maybe there were elements of it that made sense, but the aftermath of it seems like it doesn't make any sense at all. Because,
well, totally. Yeah, there's a lot of things, right? They're well-intended.
Yeah.
But they just have unfortunate consequences that people either didn't predict, or maybe cynically they did and it was to their benefit. But anyways.
Yeah. I'll skip some of these bullets. For both the multiple choice and writing sample sections, time and a half, i.e. 53 minutes per multiple choice section, was the accommodated category most frequently approved for all test administrations in this study. Note that under the terms of the consent decree, time and a half became the minimum extra time accommodation beginning in December of 2015. And I had forgotten about that. When I reread this yesterday, I had my head in my hands, because time and a half does not level the playing field. Time and a half wildly biases the test in favor of people who have time and a half. Like 5 minutes. Imagine, and if you're a student out there who's scoring like 165, imagine what you could do with 5 more minutes. Now imagine what you could do with 18 more minutes. Time and a half is actually slightly more than time and a half, because 35 minutes divided by two is 17 and a half. They rounded that up to 18. So you actually get 53 minutes, not 35 minutes. Imagine how much you could do with 18 more minutes. And that's the minimum that they're allowed to approve now. So if you get a doctor's note and you ask for extra time, you're going to get at least 18 extra minutes to do a 35 minute section, which is just, as an LSAT teacher, you know, I've been in this business now for 15 years, and that's just like, it's laughable. I mean, it's just absurd that somebody should have that much more time, let alone when people request 70 minutes, they get 70 minutes.
Yeah, it's insane. I do remember when accommodations were way more strict, almost no one got them. But I do remember on occasion, a person here or there would get maybe 5 minutes extra. And it kind of made sense. Like it's a big help.
Yeah.
5 minutes is a huge help, but it's not crazy. It's not like they're taking an astronomically different test.
Yeah. And if you're like mildly dyslexic, or if you have, I don't know, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert in these issues at all, but it will help you a lot to get just a bit more time. And that seems, if they could take it on a case by case basis and give people like a more, you know, it fits the student accommodation, then it would mm-hmm. seem like a hell of a lot more fair, but their hands are tied by mm-hmm. this consent decree. And it's 53 minutes minimum if anybody asks for extra time, which is, it's just, again, that's in gaming terms, it's OP. Okay, so some of these demographic trends are interesting. There were more male than female accommodated test takers in those report years, whereas there were more female than male non-accommodated test takers across the same study period. That could be because of an incidence of these, you know, ADD, ADHD among the male population, potentially.
Sure. Yeah, certainly.
It could also be that males tend more to, like, maybe males are more likely to ask for accommodations just because it's like, well, I get an advantage. Why wouldn't I ask for an advantage?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Here's a big problematic thing. African American and Asian accommodated test takers were underrepresented, and Caucasian/white accommodated test takers were overrepresented compared to their representation in the non-accommodated group. Other racial and ethnic subgroups were similarly represented in the accommodated group compared to the non-accommodated group. Oh, well, it looks like at this point in 2017, at least it wasn't like discriminating against other racial ethnic subgroups, but it's bad times that African-American accommodated test takers are underrepresented. There was a greater proportion of older accommodated test takers than is typically observed in the non-accommodated group. Older people tend to have more money.
Yeah, and know how to go to a doctor and ask for accommodations and just deal with the paperwork and procedures. The idea might even come to their head, I wonder if I can get accommodations for this, in a way that someone who's newer to the system may not think about.
Yeah, the older you are, the more shit you've done and the more shit you just know how to do. And you just know it's not that big of a deal, right? Somebody who's 18 is like, well, I don't want to schedule a doctor's appointment, go in and visit the doctor and blah, blah, blah. And I would be like, I'm just going to email my doctor. I could take care of this without even a visit, potentially.
Yeah.
Okay. Continuing down this just horrifying list of bullets. Accommodated and extra time test takers had higher average LSAT scores in 18 of the 20 test administrations in this report compared to the non-accommodated group.
Okay, just a correlation, right?
Sure, it's just a correlation. But I mean, that correlation also seems to hurt. It seems to like show how bad this is.
Yeah.
Because if that makes it sound like it's the rich getting richer, right? It's either, you know, it could be causal, and I'm sure it is, that the extra time is allowing people to score higher. That's a problem. But it's also a problem since we know that older and whiter people are more likely to get accommodated. Well, those older, whiter people, rich, you know, older means richer. And so, like, people with more resources, more access to healthcare, more likely to get accommodated. Not only that, but they tend to outperform on the LSAT to begin with. And so the scoreboard is showing now that back in 2017, at least, that the accommodated test takers were outscoring the non-accommodated test takers.
Yeah. So are you saying essentially either the accommodation is causing the scores to go up, which is a problem, because it's causing them to go up more than we want them to, right?
Yes, that's a problem.
Or even if it's not the cause, then what we're saying is people who have better abilities to do on the to do well on the test are actually getting help.
Yeah.
That'd be
weird
too.
I'm saying both of those things. It's not an or, it's a both.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, why not both of those things?
Yikes.
Yeah. How about this? Test takers who tested twice under accommodated slash extra time testing conditions exhibited similar score gains on average compared to the non-accommodated group, while those who switched from non-accommodated to accommodated slash extra time testing conditions exhibited very high score gains on average. I can't remember if the report tells you what those score gains actually were, but it seems like you get accommodations, you are likely to get very high score gains just from getting accommodations.
And it's funny that they put so many numbers in here, but they don't put this in, right? Like, well, I want to know what that number is, but
yeah, it's in the summary. Scary. It's in the summary, but it's not, I don't know if it's in the report. The report is long, so maybe people can dig into that. Anyway, that's the last report we have from LSAC in 2017. And I wanted to look and see, you know, what are our trends? Like, what's going on in, we have a database. So what's going on in our user base? Currently, about 15% of active paid users have accommodations in the daemon. That's way up from these numbers in 2017 in the LSAC report. About 28% of our students with a recent score above 170 have accommodations. So again, 15% of users have accommodations. 28% of our students who have scored above 170 have accommodations. Roughly double more likely to score above 170 if you have accommodations.
Yep.
Among our user base. For all the reasons that we've said before.
Yeah.
A little over 29% of students with 175 plus scores have accommodations. So at least it doesn't get dramatically worse between 170 and 175, but it does get slightly worse between 170 and 175. And yeah, to put it in perspective, Ben, you said earlier that there was a report that came out recently, and I think they update this all the time. So there actually is recent data on this. Scores above 170 have shot up since COVID. Scores above 175 have more than doubled since COVID. I think part of that is taking the test online. I think a big part of that is the increase in accommodations. Do we want to wrap that up and say anything more about that? Like, whose fault is this? Why is this happening?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of whose fault it is, it's the consent decree, right?
Yeah, the Department of Fair Employment and Housing v. Law School Admission Council. And I don't know how that site got or how that suit got brought by the United States government, specifically the Department of Fair Employment and Housing that brought the suit on behalf of students who needed accommodations or claimed they needed accommodations. And maybe they did need accommodations. And maybe Law School Admission Council was too stringent with the accommodations. And removing the asterisk seems like maybe that's a good idea, right? If we're trying to level the playing field, if we're trying to be fair, why would we then also put an asterisk on the score report that said this student got extra time and give the law schools an opportunity to discriminate, right? Like that asterisk seems like I'm less worried about that. So now when you get accommodations, you do not, the schools don't know that you got accommodations. Side note though, they do on many applications ask you to explain if you had big score increases between one official test and another official test. And as we described earlier, people who take the test non-accommodated and then take the test accommodated tend to exhibit very high score gains. Our hypothesis remains that when they ask you that question, they are fishing to see if you're going to say something like, oh yeah, I got accommodations. That's why I improved so much.
Which you do not have to do.
you do not and should not do that. That is not a thing that you want to do. You want to tell them, I knew I could do better, so I took it again. You know, I or something along those lines. But you just don't say, oh yeah, I finally got accommodated. Because then they'll know a piece of information that they didn't need to know. And that doesn't help that's not helpful to you. You know, at best, that's neutral. They're never going to think that that's a feather in your cap. And it is very likely to, you know, that they're not legally allowed to discriminate against you. But if you tell them that information, now all of a sudden they might just, looking at two applications side by side, they might become more interested in the other one.
Yeah.
If you let them know that piece of information. It just seems as if the ruling went too far. I mean, the consent decree went too far. The 53 minute minimum, that's too far. And what's happened is they have basically now just started giving accommodations to anybody who can get a doctor's note. It's really problematic for lots of different reasons, as discussed above. I don't think that it's law school admission counsel's fault at all. I think that they probably hate this as much or even more than we do. They were the ones who were fighting a lawsuit, after all. It'd be really interesting to get a new report out of LSAC. You know, I wonder why that information has not been coming out. I have a feeling that if the data did come out, it would be pretty shocking to hear how many people are getting accommodated today.
Yeah.
Is this something that students should worry about? Is this something that students can do anything about?
I mean, people have been listening to our conversation. If they feel like they need an accommodation, then they can and probably should get one. Other than that, you just have to get the best LSAT score you can get. That's how the game is played.
Yeah. To get accommodations, you have to sign up for an official LSAT and request accommodations for that test. You will have to provide supporting documentation when you apply for that accommodation. And if you have a note from a doctor, psychiatrist, psychologist, I don't even know what like the standards, like will a nurse practitioner work? I would guess probably. Certainly, if you take a prescription drug, you're going to get whatever accommodation you ask for. Be careful about asking for 70 minutes if you don't really want 70 minutes, because if you ask for 70 minutes, that's what you're going to get. So make sure you ask for the amount of time that you actually want. And what if you're not accommodated? What if you know for sure that you're never going to do this? You're never going to ask for accommodations. Is it something that you should worry about?
Well, no, because all you can do is the best you can do. And that's what you should do regardless of this situation, right? So you just got to focus on yourself and getting the best possible LSAT score you can get. Schools at the very top are going to have more applicants with higher scores. Well, that's true for all schools. It's just going to trickle down. So the need for a higher LSAT score is greater today than it was a few years ago, but it's always been true. It's just, okay, maybe you have to take the test one more time and eke out a couple more points, but you should do that anyway.
Yeah. And people can and do, I would say still the majority of people can and do score. The majority of people who score in the 170s don't have accommodations, right? The majority of people who take the test don't have accommodations. I hope we haven't seen the actual numbers from LSAT. that is the truth in our database, though.
Yeah.
You know, it's still only 15% of active paid users who have accommodations, and
That could be a biased group, right, too, because we talk about this all the time. So the percentage of people who work with us and know about accommodations, because a lot of people don't even know about them.
No, you're privileged if you're even working with us, right? I mean, you're in a lot of ways, you're privileged if you're even listening to this podcast, because it's like, oh, so you have a media player, you have time to sit there and listen to a podcast or watch a YouTube. You're there. There's a lot of privilege that gets you to this information. Certainly people who are paying for LSAT prep. Yeah. People who pay for LSAT prep, I'm sure, are more likely to be accommodated.
Yeah.
Because they have access to healthcare. They have, you know, the advice of professionals telling them that they should get accommodations if they are justified. Okay. Let's move on.
Yep. This next one is from Finn. The subject is thoughts on retaking the LSAT 5 times, but not top scorer.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. I'm a big fan of the show and the platform. I know this topic has been discussed in depth many times, but what if you max out on your attempts and don't make it into the 170s? I've taken the LSAT 3 times already. November of 23 was a 159. January was a 165. February was a 166. And I'm registered for April. My range is more where I want it to be, consistently high 160s to upper 170s. Because of the only 1 point increase between my January and February scores, I'm worried that retaking it again will seem like a lapse of judgment. Also, the June test registration date is before the April LSAT score release date, so I would have to register for that just to have the opportunity to take it. Of course, if my April score is high enough, I can always just burn the $250. Listening to the show, I know y'all don't think admissions offices care about the number of attempts because you have prior students at Yale and Harvard who took it 5 times. Do you think outside T14 care more? Or would they follow Harvard, Yale, Stanford practices? I'm sorry I laughed at that. Schools outside the top 14, if anything, they care less because they have fewer applicants. They're more desperate for applicants. They don't give a shit. They will tell you that they care. You know, I always remember that meeting that I was in where that pre-law advisor from Kansas, University of Kansas, pre-law advisor was in there saying, oh yeah, most people don't score higher than 160. And yeah, you know, if you have a score in that range, no, you should just go ahead and apply right now. And we do raise an eyebrow if people take the test multiple times. All she wanted was for you to apply right now. She doesn't give a shit. She's not out for your best interest. She wants you to apply to her law school. This was a pre-law advisor who also worked at the law school. She was in admissions at the law school, and she was the pre-law advisor for the undergrad, which is just not good for the undergrads. Yeah. Anyway, They might say shit like, well, we see all your scores and, oh, well, you know, we might ask you to explain. They don't care. It's your highest LSAT that's going to determine your admission and your scholarships. And that's even more true at lower ranked schools than it is at higher ranked schools. But again, we have sent people to Harvard and Yale who took it 5 times. So nobody cares whether you take it multiple times. What other advice do you have for Finn?
I would sign up for June to keep that option open, 100%.
Yeah, you give yourself the option to take the test. Another example of the rich getting richer, you know, if you have the resources to do that, then you should do it. Because if you score even 1 point higher, we've said for a million years on this show that 1 point of LSAT equals $10,000 of scholarships. And even if it's not certain that you're going to score higher, it's an awful nice investment. It's a low, relatively low price for a huge potential return. I wanted to comment about Finn. You need to focus more on your practice test scores and less on your official scores. Finn is like, well, I only improved 1 point between January and February, so then I'm worried about taking it in April. I don't give a shit. Those are just 2 data points alongside all of your practice test data points. And you're telling me that your PTs are in the high 160s to the high 170s. Well, there's lots of data points. There are some data points in the 165, 166 range, and you could score 165, 166 again. I don't care. I care about those data points that are 170 and 172 and 178. And you just got to start thinking about the upside and not worry about small improvements. Also, how common is this, Ben? People are like, well, my official score only improved by 1 point, or my official score didn't improve at all, so I'm clearly not ready to take it.
Yeah, they just give extraordinary weight to that because it's official and it's exactly the same test that you're taking in the Demon.
Yeah, they're the same tests. It's just those happen to be bad days for you. Now, you might be doing something different, Finn, on the day on your official test days, and you need to investigate those. Have a heart to heart with yourself and figure out why is it that I'm performing at the bottom of my range during my official tests? What am I doing differently? It could just be luck. Maybe you're doing everything exactly the same way and those scores are within your range and you're just doing everything the exact same way and you just happen to get bad scores in your range. That's fine. That's luck and there's nothing you could do about that. But it could also be that you're clinching, you know? You're trying extra super hard those days. And that's not good. You don't want to try extra super hard those days. You want to just do the exact same thing. Just let it flow the exact same way you're just letting it flow in practice. You just need to let it flow on your official test. You've got two more shots at it. And eventually, I think that you're going to get, if your range is high 160s to high 170s, you're a good bet to outscore your current high of 166 on one or both of these upcoming tests. Next one's from Anonymous. It's about a character addendum.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. First generation American, undergrad, graduate, and hopefully soon to be a law student. I've been a listener for almost a year now and a Demon subscriber for a little less than that. Progress is slow, but nevertheless progress. I'm taking your advice on waiting to apply early for the next cycle, and I am slowly beginning to think about the pieces to my application. My one issue is that when I was 20, I got an MIP, minor in possession of alcohol, an open container charge, which have since been removed from my record due to community service and paying the fines. I know I need to make that known on the application itself, but when it comes to the addendum, how much detail do I include in there? And honestly, what is even that supposed to look like? Word document? Letter format addressed to the admissions head or team? I'm a little in the dark here. Thanks so much.
Does it need to be in a letter format with addresses and all that? I don't think so.
Nope. It's you can put it in a Word doc and then you write a short paragraph and then you turn it into a PDF and upload it.
Yeah. Or they might just have a text field in which case you just put the text in there, but don't overthink it. It's like two sentences. You're just going to acknowledge, I mean, they might ask you for dates and place and that stuff. If they do, then provide that information. If they don't, then probably not. But what you said is pretty much fine. When I was 20, I got a minor in possession and an open container charge, which have since been removed from my record due to community service and paying the fines.
Done.
I don't need to say a word more than that.
I don't think so. I mean, it's been removed and you did community. Like, that's a positive note. You're paying your fine. Maybe even want to switch it. I paid the fines and did community service. So it ends on community service.
Sure. And right. But just keep it short. You've answered the question. You have provided them with the information they need to know. MIPs are super common. That type of thing happens all the time. The open container, that's actually a bigger deal because that's a vehicle violation. Still super common that this type of thing happens. You could definitely call your state bar and ask them about it. They might have some advice. If you feel like you need more help on this issue, you could talk to Leslie, who works on our team. She charges by the hour. She has written these kinds of things in the past. She might have some more information. Go to the team or about us or tutoring page on lsatdemon.com if you want to learn more about that service.
This next one is from Emmy.
Yeah.
Is writing in an addendum worth it?
Hi, I've been listening to the pod for about 2 months and have been a demon for about 1 month. I have seen a massive improvement, not only in my scores, but in my confidence as well. That's great to hear. Can't thank you guys enough. I'm aiming for a T14 school and thought I was on pretty good footing, but as I've been listening to your podcast, I've been comparing myself and my UGPA with a lot of your listeners who write in. We know that that's a problem, don't we, Ben?
Yeah.
Just generally in life. Always bad. Comparing yourself to anybody is always bad. I graduated last year with a GPA of 3.79. I have work experience working on a TV show's rights and clearances for a year. Well, that sounds like interesting work. That's like if you want to use a music in your show,
Yeah.
You got to go get the song cleared.
Very legal.
Legal adjacent experience. Yeah. Love that. Yeah. I'm trying to get my LSAT as high as possible. However, this year I got diagnosed with ADHD and now take meds. Well, that means you're going to automatically get accommodated on the LSAT. Like, not automatically.
Yeah.
Easily. If you ask, I should have said. Yeah. But you are diagnosed with ADHD and you are medicated, you will 100% get accommodations on the LSAT. If you want 53 minutes, have your doctor say she should get 53 minutes. If you want 70 minutes, have your doctor say she should get 70 minutes. During my undergrad, I was also in a physically abusive relationship. I'm not wanting to avoid responsibility by blaming my UGPA on ADHD or abuse, but I know they both did impact my performance. Would it be helpful for applications to mention either of those in an addendum? Oh, God. Okay. Or would it sound like victim signaling? Thanks, guys.
Let's stop for 1 second here. 3.79 is an excellent GPA. Who knows what it will exactly be once you put it through LSAC's translator, right?
Yep.
But it's going to be close to that. It's an excellent GPA. Don't worry about this. Don't bring up abuse. Don't bring up the fact that you had ADHD, because then the schools will think that you had accommodations, which you likely will, hopefully at this point, get. But yeah, crush, no addendum.
Crush the LSAT and absolutely do not write an addendum.
Yeah,
it will come off as victim signaling or putting the burden on someone else. 3.79 is not that bad. I mean, it's not that great for T14. It's probably, you're going to be a splitter at the T14. You're going to be a splitter. That's your best chance at the T14 is to be a splitter. You're going to need a high LSAT to outweigh this GPA at T14 schools. I can see Ben frantically looking up the bottom of the T14 to see what the median is there. I'm going to take a shot at 3.86.
Okay, I'm looking at UCLA, and wait, did you say 50th or 25th?
50th.
50th, 3.92.
Yeah. The GPAs in the T14 are good, but you can get in as a splitter, especially at a school like UCLA. Sounds like you might be in LA since you're working on TV shit. You know, UCLA is a great school for you if you can show them an LSAT score. What's UCLA's median LSAT?
Yeah, UCLA's median LSAT is 170.
Okay, so that's the thing you can control, Emmy. And without accommodations, many of us do score in the 170s, you know, including every teacher at LSAT Demon. We have some accommodated students on staff as well, but people score above 170 on this test. You can do it. You can, if you're cut out for the T14, you can score in the 170s. The majority of people in the T14 score in the 170s and above, right? The median at UCLA at the bottom of the top 14 is 170. So more than half the people at UCLA are scoring 170. As you climb higher in the ranks of the T14, almost everybody's scoring in the 170s. So you need to score in the 170s. The fact that you're accommodated and take meds for ADHD means that you absolutely can get accommodations on the LSAT to help you reach that goal. Crush the LSAT. Don't write any addendum. I think you're a great candidate specifically for UCLA, but you can go ahead and apply to other schools in the T14 as well.
Well, I looked at other schools, including Michigan. Michigan's 50th percentile for GPA is 3.85, which you're much closer to. So who knows? After you submit your grades to LSAC, maybe you're at the median for Michigan.
And you're certainly not like atrociously low. Like no school is going to look at that. You know, maybe Yale looks at that and goes, yeah, no. But there are lots of schools in the T14 that admit lots of people with 3.79s.
Yeah. And are there any grades that you could get changed?
Worth investigating. Yeah. If there are, you know, you did have this physically abusive relationship. Was it documented at the time? Could you go back to your school? Like maybe there's one D or C or C minus or whatever. Maybe there's a bad grade or two that if you got those changed to a pass, would immediately bump your UGPA on the LSAC calculations. So before you upload your transcripts to LSAC, you might want to investigate, like do some lawyer shit. call your school, you know, make a good case for, well, don't just pick up the phone immediately. Figure out what your case is going to be. Once you know what you want, start making some phone calls and tell, you know, explain your story to them. Find somebody who's sympathetic. See if you can get one or more of those grades changed to a pass. Maybe you can get the professor to vouch for you. I don't know. Maybe your TA at the time knew that you were going through this. I don't know. Got to do the type of thing that a lawyer would do. And you could very well get some. We've seen people, we've heard people get grades changed. So maybe you can rehabilitate that 3.7 a little bit. But it's not that bad anyway.
Yeah. Keep us posted. Let's go to tips from a departing demon. So this departing demon is Sierra. Sierra went from a 146 to a 163, 17 point change. Spent 160 or so hours studying. Sierra writes, believe in yourself and focus on what you need to get what you want. Scholarship money, admission to certain schools, etc. Don't get too caught up on the numbers and how everyone else is doing.
Perfect. Perfect answer to Emmy's question above. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, do what you can control. And Emmy, you think your old GPA, most of that you probably can't control, but there are things about it that maybe you could rehabilitate, as we discussed above. Certainly stop comparing yourself to anybody else. Don't get too caught up in the numbers. Don't get too caught up in how everybody else is doing. Focus on, as we said at the top of the show, focus on one question at a time. Why did I miss this specific question? Why is the right answer right? Why is the wrong answer wrong? Why didn't I see that at the time? Learn from those mistakes. Get your LSAT as high as you can possibly get it. Work hard. Crush it like Sierra did.
Okay, word of the week comes from Eric.
I have never seen this word before. Obscurantism.
Okay. It sounds like to obscure or to make something
absolutely
unclear. That's my guess.
Yeah, obscurantism. Obscurantism. That would be the practice of obscuring.
So I just clicked on the definition. It's opposition to the spread of knowledge, a policy of withholding knowledge from the general public.
Oh, I see. Okay. Second definition, it's a style, as in literature or art, characterized by deliberate vagueness or abstruseness. I could see that word popping up on like a humanities passage in reading comprehension, can't you? Like,
yeah,
a passage that was about obscurantism. They like to find words like this that are like, oh my God, I've definitely never seen this word before. And so we're going to put it on the LSAT to see if students will freak out about it.
Yeah, because you can figure it out from the root of this word, and I'm sure the context of the passage will be sufficient to get it, but some people will panic.
If not the straight up definition of it, right?
Yeah.
In the passage. But yeah. Awesome. Thanks, Eric, for putting that on the agenda.
I have one other word. I was watching Dune 1 with Maria, and the Duke said to his head security officer, if you want to gain absolution, find the remaining security threats. Because the head security officer was trying to resign for a mistake that he had made. And absolution, it's not a word that I had heard before. If I have, I never recognized it. I've heard of redemption or, you know, penance or something like that. But
Absolution is a word that's more familiar to me. I don't know why specifically. I'm not a Catholic, but I have a feeling that Catholics would be familiar with it, because I think that you like go to confession and then the priest tells you to do your 59 Hail Marys or whatever, and then you get absolution. Absolution means forgiveness, right?
Yeah. So the definition is a formal release from guilt, obligation, or punishment. And then a secondary definition is an ecclesiastical declaration of forgiveness of sins.
There we go.
So, yeah. Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us on our website, thinkinglsat.com, or on socials at LSAT Demon. Questions about LSAT Demon? You can always email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 446 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.